could be sweeter than MacReady when I meet her in the morning.
The morning.
With the morning.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Joe Simpson for the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Triangle Yesteryear. On this program, you will hear reminiscences of life around North Carolina's Triangle area, written by local authors. On today's program, I'll be reading excerpts from Georgianne Eubanks' book, The Month of Their Ripening, North Carolina Heritage Foods Through the Year. January. Snow. In North Carolina, snow blooms in the air as suddenly as a bank of dogwoods in spring. And, like the dogwood, we can never precisely predict its coming and going. It rarely piles up high enough or lingers long enough, in most areas of the state, to grow gray and sooty. In January, there is little else in nature that presents itself to us that we can eat. Snow, however, is a dessert that literally falls from the sky, and when it does, North Carolinians, particularly in the Piedmont and points east, declare it a party. For us, snow never fails to quicken the pulse and slow the pace. Snow gives us license to loosen up. It brightens the view and blankets the landscape with a flag of truce. And once the snow piles high enough, we make snow cream, a very simple treat like ice cream, which normally accompanies the most universal celebration across cultures, a birthday party. Even for mountain folk who get the most of it, snow requires an adjustment from business as usual to an almost gleeful awareness of possible hazards, and the promise of certain culinary and other pleasures. One winter, teaching writing to middle schoolers in western North Carolina, I learned about the passionate stirrings that come even among those who get the most snow. With nearly 1,700 residents, Burnsville is the Yancey County seat. The town was established in 1834, a year after the celebrated New Ray Inn opened. From the New Ray, where both Elvis Presley and Mark Twain allegedly dined and spent the night, you can step beyond the porch into the town square and see mountaintops in every direction. The subtle gradations of color in the peaks surrounding the village produce a visual Doppler effect. The shades of blue grow lighter the farther away the mountain. Yancey County has 17 peaks that are higher than 6,000 feet, the highest being Mount Mitchell, the tallest east of the Dakotas, where 21 inches of snow fell in 24 hours in January 2016. Thus, despite the warm name, Burnsville is North Carolina snow country, a place where a visitor might assume that children and adults would be quite accustomed to the more than occasional presence of the white stuff, as abundant as the biscuit flour that was once stowed in the New Ray pantry. But even here, snow is still a cause for celebration. It was January when the local arts council hired me to teach 5 classes on creative writing to every student at East Yancey Middle School, about a mile from the Burnsville Town Square. Right after lunch period, on a gray and biting afternoon, I was about to give my 3rd lesson in the series to a rambunctious group of 7th graders, mostly boys, who had been relegated to ISS or in-school suspension for troublemaking. The principal had warned me at the beginning of the week that this group had burned out 3 teachers before Christmas break. He was grateful that I was at least holding down 1 class period for the first week of the new year while he cobbled together substitutes to fill the rest of these students' day. More than once, I'd caught a glimpse of him in the hall outside the room, making sure I was still there. On this particular day, my lesson was about writing vivid description. With the 4th period bell, the students rushed to their seats, and I entered the ring. "So who can tell me," I said, "what is a simile?" A hand shot up. "Is that like when the whole school goes to the gym on Fridays for a program?" It took me a minute. "No, that is an assembly," I said. Travis, the boy who had offered his best guess, grinned. Though he might not have known what a simile was, he knew how to get my goat. Travis was a handsome kid and a strong junior varsity football player, I'd been told. His cheeks had a perpetual flush, as if he'd just dashed in from the field. Travis also had leadership ability, but this trait was usually directed toward guiding others into his mischief. I explained how a simile is a figure of speech that compares two unlikely things using the word like or as. Puzzled faces. I gave some examples. Her face looked like a bologna sandwich. The wind blew like a freight train. There was a glimmer of recognition among those who were listening. Okay, I said. So that's a simile. I wrote the word on the board with my back turned. Someone called out that the word looked like smile. Uh-huh, I said, turning around to face them once more. Now, what's a metaphor? Utter silence. And then a big-wristed boy in the back row, whose arms seemed to be outgrowing his sleeves before our very eyes, threw his arm up and blurted, "Cows!" The class laughed. I didn't get it. "What's a metaphor?" Travis hollered like a cheerleader and jumped up, shaking his hands loose in the air like pom-poms. "Cows!" the class roared back. Travis then sat, crossed his arms, and stared at me. I felt like I was pulling helplessly on the end of a long rope attached to a large, unmoving cow. This was not a new feeling in my role as guest artist in the schools. And then, out of nowhere, chaos erupted. The students jumped up out of their seats. Some desks fell over. Books hit the floor like claps of thunder. They ran for the bank of windows on the south side of the classroom. It had begun to snow outside. Small but discernible flakes, flying by fast. The students examined the heavens and the earth, and then, just as suddenly as they had risen, moaned and went back to their seats. "It's just a blowin'," Travis declared. He explained to me that snow in Burnsville comes two ways, either a blowin', meaning flurries were flying sideways but not accumulating, or a laying, which meant school might get out early because it was already sticking. I told them we'd listen for any important announcements about early dismissal over the intercom, which I half hoped for myself. They hushed, and I started ad-libbing. "The native people in Alaska..." "Eskimos!" the big boy in the back shouted. "Yes," I said. "The Eskimos, or Inuit people, have lots of different words for snow, because snow can take so many forms and shapes up there near the North Pole. So let's come up with some similes for snow. You all know already about wet snow and dry snow, right? Snow that sticks and snow that flies. Sometimes it's big flakes, sometimes they're small." Nods all around the room. A sullen girl raised a limp hand. "Are we going to have to write again today?" she whined. "Let's just talk this out," I smiled. "I'll write whatever you all say on the board." I asked them to complete the sentence. "The snow fell like..." They called out their answers as fast as I could chalk them up. "Popcorn." "Chicken feathers." "Salt." "Sugar." "Grits." "Ice cream." Then their ideas began to come more slowly and grow more fanciful. "Moths." "Q-tips." "Ashes." "Chalk dust." "Stuffed animal guts," Travis said. "My great-granddaddy's beard at the barber shop," said another boy in the back. All excellent similes, I told them, and I hoped they might remember the concept. Their expertise with snow, because of its frequency in Yancey County, made their images and associations all the more fanciful. I noticed, too, how so many of the first similes had naturally referenced something edible. The term edible memory comes from the University of Wisconsin sociologist Jennifer A. Jordan. In her 2015 study, Edible Memory, The Lure of Heirloom Tomatoes and Other Forgotten Foods, Jordan explains that she came to the concept as she considered the power of food as ritual in her own childhood. Even though her grandmother was an excellent scratch baker, she would always have a certain store-bought mix for spice cake whenever her granddaughter visited. The boxed mix even came with its own baking pan. "We'd open the package, add water, and mix it up directly in that aluminum pan," Jordan writes. "Later, we'd ice it with the foil packet of bright white frosting that also came in the package. An important part of the whole experience was the time spent in the kitchen together, mixing up the cake, and then eating it washed down with glasses of milk, catching up on the important events in the lives of a 9-year-old and an 80-year-old. Jordan was struck by how such food memories sit deep within us, how particular meals and the preparation of certain foods, even something as banal as a boxed cake mix, can shape someone's identity and sense of place in the world. As she put it, "Something happens when we eat, the transformation, even transubstantiation, of these molecules into energy and strength. But it can also transform into social bonds and memories, connections within families and communities and larger social groups, as well as stark divisions and distinctions, ways of resisting or oppressing, controlling and rebelling. Food, its production, consumption, and distribution, shapes and transforms a range of places as well. Kitchens and dining tables, fields and forests." She goes on, "Edible memory encompasses ways of talking about the world, but also ways of acting on and moving through the world. I found edible memory propelling people into action, to save seeds, to plant gardens, to eat meals, and tell stories." For North Carolinians, the ritual of making snow cream from the simplest ingredients, sugar, snow, vanilla, and cream, evokes a particular place and time for many of us. Memories of this dish, like Jordan's spice cake, often involve grandparents, impromptu preparation, enormous anticipation, and a strong sense of belonging. In North Carolina, the western mountains actually help to protect the rest of the state from chilling winds, temperatures, and precipitation blowing in from the west. According to the State Climate Office, altitude is the most important factor in the temperatures, and hence the amount of snow we expect across the state. As you head east from the Appalachian Mountains, the landscape slopes downward into the rolling Piedmont, and then flattens out as it descends toward the ocean. As the Climate Office describes the extremes, "The average annual temperature at South Point on the lower coast is nearly as high as that of interior northern Florida, while the average on the summit of Mount Mitchell is lower than that of Buffalo, New York." The fall line in North Carolina is the geological marker that defines the boundary where the hard igneous rocks of the Piedmont transition into the softer sedimentary rocks of the coastal plain. As the landscape lowers farther across the eastern side of the fall line, the probability of a good snowfall also declines. Historic Highway 1, running northeast and southwest up the eastern seaboard, was built along this fall line, more or less. Today's Interstate 95, a bit farther east, forms the boundary that weather forecasters often use to point out where a winter storm is likely to transition from snow, on the western side, to frozen rain, sleet, or just plain rain to the east. A snow deep enough to supply the ingredients for snow cream is therefore less and less likely the farther east you go in the state, and arguably the memories of snow cream are thus more dear, or at least rare, in the eastern direction. I set out to test this hypothesis by inviting some of North Carolina's most distinguished storytellers on both sides of the fall line to share their snow cream memories. Writer and editor Dawn Shamp was raised in Roxboro, the seat of Person County, on the Virginia border. Her part of the Piedmont tends to get more snow than the better-known Research Triangle area, just to the south. During snow events, the county becomes a favored destination for roving television reporters who are dispatched to the media market fringes to describe, on the quarter hour, the changing nature of every flake that falls. Just in case you're not from here, snow is always news in the Piedmont, sometimes worthy of canceling regular programming. Shamp, who now lives in Durham, confirmed the slightly greater accumulations of snow she experienced as a girl in Roxboro, the memory of which seemed to magnify her enthusiasm. "Oh my gosh, I loved snow cream when I was a kid. I can taste it right now. Nothing compares. The most vivid memory I have is being in Grandma's kitchen, watching Aunt Susie mix up a batch of snow cream in a giant, I mean giant, opaque Tupperware bowl for my cousins and me, then her dishing it up into these smaller pastel-colored Tupperware bowls. Types of bowls, you will soon notice, are key to many snow cream memories. Tupperware, of course, is an important generational marker for those raised in the 1960s. I, too, have this memory of the sound of sugar and snow scraping against the bottom of a giant plastic bowl that was brought down only for special occasions and that had to be stowed out of the way on a high kitchen shelf because it took up so much space. I asked Champ if the enormous bowl happened to be the same one that her grandmother used to mix her cornbread dressing and then store it in the fridge before holiday baking commenced. Affirmative. According to eBay, this would be the two-piece vintage Tupperware large fix-and-mix bowl, which held 26 cups and came with a white ceiling top. The bowl would have been either pastel yellow or jadeite green. Champ's grandmother's was jadeite, as was my mother's. Thus, the accoutrements of cooking or serving edible memories take on a nostalgic luster themselves, just like those dented buckets my grandfather and I used to gather scuppernongs. Novelist and short story master Jill McCorkle grew up in Lumberton, where I-95 runs near the heart of town on one side and the Lumber River snakes by on the other. Lumberton is therefore east of the fall line in North Carolina, and a good snowfall was very rare there. My mother would put out a big yellow Pyrex bowl on a high post that was in the yard, McCorkle said. It had been a stand for the bird feeder. She warned us that we could only eat what fell directly into that bowl up high. No fair scooping anything up anywhere else. No yellow snow. When the bowl finally filled up, the children brought it inside. Jill's mother, Melba, would inspect the snow suspiciously, and then stir in a mixture of sugar, milk, and vanilla. "We'd eat some and then keep the rest in the freezer for months and taste of it from time to time," Jill said. Fiction writer and James Baldwin scholar Randall Keenan was raised in the 1960s in the farming community of Chinkapin in Duplin County near the northeast Cape Fear River, around 60 miles east of the fall line. Describing the family recipe in the hands of his great-aunt, whom he called Mama, Keenan makes her snow cream sound both delicate and elegant. Mama would brush a significant quantity of fresh snow into a pan. She would sprinkle it with a little sugar, pour in maybe a third of a can of evaporated milk, depending on the amount of snow. She would add a few drops of vanilla extract and stir lightly. Ain't that how everybody does it? I also asked the current North Carolina poet laureate, Shelby Stephenson, about his snow cream experience. Raised on a farm in Johnston County, right along the fall line, he was quick to suggest that the closer to the cow, the better the snow cream. His mother used fresh cream from the family cow, he said with nostalgia, and, as poets laureate tend to do, he soon wrote and sent me this remembrance of Johnston County snow. Bring back the snow cream. My mother could make it, off the bat beating the vanilla, and milk from our cow, some sugar, and there it was, the snow. Still falling outside, bumping the big oak limbs at the kitchen window, and she hummed when she'd make it. What a longing memory throws over the smell I could feel in that kitchen. For more historical data on snow cream, I then turned to The State, once a weekly magazine in North Carolina, now a monthly called Our State. With its long practice of holding up a mirror to the state, revealing the habits, quirks, and passions of Tar Heels, the magazine often turned its attention to the subject of snow cream, which in turn stirred up memories from many readers. The snow cream recipes offered over the years also reveal variations in the types of milk and other ingredients used in family recipes. Some state readers called for the addition of an egg or two, which would be mixed in with the other kitchen ingredients. The brave ate the eggs raw in their snow cream, not necessarily aware of the risk of salmonella poisoning. Others simmered the ingredients on the stove and let the mixture cool before pouring it into the snow. The egg formula mimics the recipe for custard-based homemade ice cream that is nowadays simmered and then poured into the canister of an ice cream freezer, wherein a dasher, cranked by hand or electricity, is surrounded by rock salt and ice, and will eventually produce ice cream. The eggs provide added fat and emulsifiers that help make the ice cream soft and creamy. In a 1981 story in The State called The Snow Eaters, the writer Maxine Carey Harker interviewed families in the eastern town of Grifton about their snow cream practices. A member of the Noble family was adamant about her preference for a raw egg in the recipe, having tried both cooked and raw egg mixtures. She also shared her resistance to canned milk. "I use dairy milk. I don't like the condensed taste." Despite her insistence upon adding a raw egg, Ms. Noble also made known her abhorrence of any eggy taste in the snow cream, which she countered with nutmeg, a durable spice that goes back to the first century. According to Hindu writings from India's Vedic period, nutmeg can also cure headaches. Handy, since snow cream eaten quickly and in great quantity can cause throbbing temples. By contrast, Dorothy Hall Ruth of High Point wrote a dismissive letter to the editor of The State in January 1983 regarding the use of eggs in snow cream. "I was so amused at the recipes calling for eggs, milk, sugar. They were making custard and pouring it raw over the snow. Real snow cream is made with thick cream from fresh cow's milk, sugar, and vanilla. Mama would skim a sheet of thick cream from a crop of milk, cold and heavy, sweeten it, and add vanilla." The addition of alcohol to snow cream has also apparently been a long tradition with some North Carolinians. T.H. Pierce of Franklin County responded to the story about the Grifton citizens' snow cream habits with something of a rant. In his letter to the State editor, Pierce explained that his neighbors had always avoided any potential harm, from pollution in the snow or from uncooked eggs, by simply adding a sufficient amount of homemade Franklin County apple brandy to their snow cream. "That stuff would neutralize anything," he wrote. Vanilla and sugar, the other two essential ingredients in snow cream, also bear brief consideration. Photographer and seasoned Southern cook Donna Campbell, who accompanied me in the field research for most of this book, makes a simple syrup of sugar and water, which she chills in the fridge while the snow is collecting outside in a metal bowl, which also conducts the cold particularly well. The chilled syrup, then mixed with cream and vanilla, is whisked frugally into the snow until the texture is like ice cream. Having the sugar already dissolved means it disperses more evenly and does not compete with the potentially grainy quality of the snow. Where I live in the Piedmont, snow rarely comes without some crunchy sleet in advance of the fluffier product. Good vanilla is also critical, and Donna always keeps a bottle of genuine Mexican vanilla on hand for the occasion. According to the former Chez Panisse pastry chef and food writer, David Leibovitz, you can also use dried vanilla beans to make your own vanilla sugar in advance. The beans, he says, can be stored in a jar of sugar, which will take on the vanilla flavor after a couple of weeks. Or you can make a vanilla infusion by adding vanilla beans to whiskey, vodka, or rum to create an adult version of snow cream. The temptations of eating snow have a long history. The Chinese were probably the first to make fruit and wine slushes and iced desserts from mountain snow that they harvested and transported over great distances, but dairy products were not used in those concoctions. Warnings against eating snow began to gain traction in the late 1800s as industrialization swept over the United States and the country's increasingly crowded cities were seen as especially dangerous. In 1892, the journal Annals of Hygiene warned that, "In a large, crowded city like New York, there are always myriads of disease germs or seeds floating in the air. Snowstorms always purify the atmosphere by catching hold of the seeds in the air and carrying them down to the ground. Hence, after a fall of snow, the air is purified, but the snow itself is defiled." The writer, a physician, strongly urged parents to prevent children from eating snow to avoid the germs that produced measles, diphtheria, and scarlet fever. A later round of warnings about the hazards of eating snow began in the era of nuclear testing in the late 1950s and early 1960s. Nuclear fallout had tainted the snow, some warned, and eating snow cream had become suspect. Durham resident Debbie McGill remembers how her mother, Bobby, read a warning about radioactive snow in the Durham Morning Herald, but when her daughters asked if they could make snow cream, she joined them in the festivities. How much could it hurt? She reasoned. Eating snow was, at best, a once-a-year event. John Pomeroy, a Canadian scientist at the University of Saskatchewan, told National Public Radio's Anne Bramley that snow can have a scrubbing brush effect on the atmosphere so that the air, or the snow, gets cleaner as the storm proceeds, and eager snow eaters should wait a few hours for this effect. As recently as the 21-inch snowfall on Mount Mitchell in 2016, which expanded into a blizzard of record proportions as it rolled up the East Coast, newspapers began a new round of warnings against snow consumption, citing a 2015 study published in the journal Environmental Science, Processes and Impacts. The study showed that snowflakes absorb particulate pollutants, and further, exhaust fumes from vehicles may interact with snow and freezing temperatures in a way that compounds the concentration of chemicals such as benzene, toluene, and xylenes, all carcinogens, in snow. Given all this information, should we now consider ourselves to be living in the post-snow cream era? Is this heritage food already done for? It is an individual decision, of course. However, if you're chary of snow eating the old-fashioned way, I found some consolation. According to Appalachian lore, there is another, healthful practice to undertake with snow when it first arrives. In 1967, the Asheville Citizen-Times columnist John Paris wrote about a mountain woman named Nancy Rathbone, who lived in Haywood County, and swore that the first snow of the season was the key to her health, but not because she ate the snow. "You know," she said, "when the first good snow comes, a snow that's about shoe-mouth deep, I get out in it and wade about in it barefooted. Been doing it since I was big enough to toddle about, and I'm nigh on to 73. Reckon you think I'm a mite tetched in the head." Well, it could be that I am, but I'll tell you one thing, and it's a fact as true as scripture. I am one that never has a cold in the winter. Never have had one, and don't expect to get one as long as I'm able to walk. Rathbone prescribed a barefoot walk in the first ground covering snow. 10 minutes or so is all it takes. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Yesteryear. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Joe Simpson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Triangle Yesteryear is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Carolina in the morning.